KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. Aisha Roscoe, good morning. In this hour, hear from Ukrainian soldiers who say that Russia has been using North Korean troops on the front line. And President Trump argues a law that requires him to spend money appropriated by Congress is unconstitutional. Find out more about the legal battle over impoundment. Plus, a new novel is about a governess who has, shall I say, a unique set of skills.
My girl is always sniffing. She's always sniffing everything, licking everything. She's kind of like visceral and animalistic.
It's Sunday, February 2nd. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Business groups are pushing back against President Trump's plan to impose stiff new tariffs on imports from Mexico, Canada, and China. NPR's Scott Horsley reports those import taxes are set to take effect on Tuesday.
President Trump says he's ordering the tariffs in an effort to curb the flow of illegal drugs and immigration. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says while Trump is right to focus on those problems, tariffs are not the answer. The chamber says taxing imports will only upend supply chains and raise prices for American families. Trump has ordered a 25% tax on most goods coming from Mexico and Canada, but he called for a smaller 10% tax on Canadian crude oil in an apparent effort to limit any spike in gasoline prices. The tariff on Chinese imports is also set at 10%. All the taxes are set to take effect on Tuesday, leaving a short window for a possible reprieve. Canada and Mexico have promised to respond to tariffs with taxes of their own on U.S. exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump wants to redirect the country away from efforts to address climate change and towards fossil fuels. NPR's Jeff Brady reports, despite a blast of executive orders, that won't happen quickly.
Trump is withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. He revoked some Biden climate orders and issued his own to boost fossil fuels. With all that, it's tempting to think a lot has changed, but it hasn't yet. Amy Myers Jaffe directs the Energy, Climate Justice, and Sustainability Lab at New York University.
Energy and climate policy, which is complex, is not a speedboat. You don't turn the wheel and the boat immediately turns around. It's more like an aircraft carrier.
Trump faces obstacles, including oil companies that aren't interested in drilling for more crude right now, plus state and local governments and private companies with their own climate programs that extend out for decades, long after Trump's four-year term. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
The National Transportation Safety Board expects to complete by tomorrow the interviews of air traffic controllers at Reagan National Airport. A passenger jet and a military helicopter collided over the Potomac River Wednesday night, killing all 67 people on the two aircraft. NTSB member Todd Inman says the investigation is not affected by another plane crash last week.
We will find out what happened, and we will do everything we can to prevent it. But I don't want anyone to think because we are working two accidents. This is what we do. Week in and week out. Just today, a lot more people are paying attention to it.
A medical transport plane had crashed in Philadelphia Friday night, killing all six people on board and one person on the ground. Marco Rubio is in Panama, his first stop on his first foreign trip as Secretary of State. He's to visit the Panama Canal today. President Trump wants the U.S. to reclaim control over the canal. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits Washington this week and is to meet with President Trump at the White House Tuesday. It's Trump's first meeting with a foreign leader since he returned to office. Before leaving Israel, Netanyahu said he'll discuss Israel's victory over Hamas. A six-week ceasefire in Gaza appears to be holding. Syria's interim president is visiting Saudi Arabia on his first foreign trip since becoming the country's new leader. He's seeking help to rebuild a country ravaged by more than a decade of war. NPR's Greg Myrie reports from Damascus.
Interim President Ahmed al-Shara flew to Saudi Arabia, a country that could provide the financial assistance that Syria desperately needs. The new Syrian leader has hosted several foreign delegations here in Damascus, but he has not previously traveled abroad since leading the rebel group that toppled the country's longtime ruler, Bashar al-Assad, back in December. Shara is trying to win support from Arab and Western governments. Many isolated Syria while Assad was in power. The new Syrian government says the sanctions imposed on the Assad regime should now be lifted. The war and those sanctions have impoverished the vast majority of Syrians. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Damascus.
The music industry honors its own tonight at the Grammy Awards in Los Angeles. Beyoncé has 11 nominations for her latest album, Cowboy Carter, in several categories, including pop and country. She's won 32 Grammys and has 99 nominations, more than any other artist. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
In addition, from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump signed executive orders on Saturday imposing a 25% tax on imports from Canada and Mexico and a 10% tariff on all goods from China. On social media, the White House said that the measure is, quote, necessary to hold China, Mexico, and Canada accountable for their promises to halt the flood of poisonous drugs into the United States. The announcement sparked fears of a trade war that could have widespread implications for the global economy. The tariffs are set to begin on Tuesday, but all three countries have been swift to respond, as our correspondents report.
In Mexico, President Claudia Sheinbaum was speaking at an event when the news of tariffs broke.
Cuando negociamos con otras naciones, cuando platicamos con otras naciones, siempre con la frente en alto.
When we negotiate with other countries, she said, we'll do so with our heads held high.
Y que siempre viva México!
Shortly thereafter, Sheinbaum categorically denied the accusations made by the White House that the Mexican state had alliances with drug cartels. Sheinbaum said she had ordered her economic minister to launch retaliatory measures against the United States. Mexico has been warning that a tariff war between the two countries would have huge effects, not just for American consumers, but also for American companies manufacturing in Mexico. The largest exporter in Mexico, for example, is the American car company General Motors. Mexico is the number one provider of cars and car parts for the United States. It's the largest provider of TV and computer screens, and one out of every three refrigerators in the U.S. comes from Mexico. Mexico's economy secretary, Marcelo Ebrard, said Americans could see a hike in prices in everything from avocados and beer to cars, trucks, and medical equipment.
Conviene tenerlo claro. El principal impacto, millones de familias en Estados Unidos tendrán que pagar 25% más.
The biggest impact, he said, is that millions of American families will have to pay 25% more. Ada Peralta, NPR News.
China's in the middle of the Lunar New Year holiday, but the government issued coordinated statements from the Commerce Ministry and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Commerce Ministry said China is strongly opposed to the tariffs, which are a serious violation of World Trade Organization rules. It said it would launch a legal challenge at the WTO. The Foreign Ministry, meanwhile, said China has been helping fight fentanyl by curbing the flow of precursor chemicals to drug cartels. But it said fentanyl was ultimately a U.S. problem, and the imposition of tariffs will inevitably undermine cooperation between China and the U.S. in fighting drugs. Both ministries threatened, quote, corresponding countermeasures, although they did not give specifics. Xu Bin is an economist at the China-Europe International Business School in Shanghai. He says that, compared to the 25% imposed on Mexico and Canada, China's 10% tariffs are more symbolic than anything, and may actually present an opportunity.
To see that Trump is attacking the allies, and China may, talk to those countries to form some kind of, coalition to fight back.
He also expects the new tariffs to spur discussions between Washington and Beijing, too. John Ruich, NPR News.
In Canada, reaction to President Trump slapping 25% tariffs on a range of Canadian products could be summed up at a National Hockey League game in Ottawa last night. The Canadian crowd booed loudly during the singing of the Star-Spangled Banner. Later, during a televised address, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made it clear Canada does not want a trade war with its neighbor and largest trading partner.
If President Trump wants to usher in a new golden age for the United States, the better path is to partner with Canada, not to punish us.
Trudeau said Canada would retaliate by imposing a 25% levy on more than $100 billion of U.S. products, including clothing, lumber, beer, and bourbon. The Prime Minister warned President Trump's tariffs will impact American jobs at auto assembly plants and elsewhere.
They will raise costs for you.
Trudeau said Canada has critical minerals and natural resources the U.S. needs. Roughly 60% of the oil the U.S. imports comes from Canada. And officials in Ottawa have warned Canada could limit those oil exports if the trade war between the two allies persists. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Ukraine has claimed for weeks that thousands of North Korean soldiers are fighting on the side of Russia in this nearly three-year war. In interviews with NPR, Ukrainian soldiers who have fought them said the North Koreans are well-trained and fearless, but have suffered large casualties. Those losses may have forced them to pull back from the front line for now. We're joined by NPR's Joanna Kakissis, who is in northeastern Ukraine, speaking to Ukrainian troops. And a note, NPR is identifying soldiers by their first names at the request of the Ukrainian military. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Aisha.
Can you start by telling us where this fighting is happening?
Sure. It's actually in a part of western Russia called the Kursk region. Ukrainians captured part of this Russian region in a surprise offensive last summer. And it's believed that they want to hold on to this land so they can use it as leverage to get back their own territory and free POWs. Russians have not been able to dislodge the Ukrainians from this part of Russia, but they have made some progress in recapturing territory recently, thanks in part to about 11,000 North Korean soldiers brought in to fight with the Russians. But here's the catch. Neither Russia nor North Korea has acknowledged that North Korean troops are fighting in this war.
Well, okay, so North Korea and Russia have denied that this is happening, but how did Ukraine confirm that these soldiers were indeed North Korean?
The Ukrainian soldiers we spoke to, and we spoke to almost a dozen of them, they said the North Koreans did wear Russian military uniforms, and this aligns with social media posts we've seen in Russia showing the North Korean soldiers being issued Russian gear. The Ukrainians heard them shouting in a language that wasn't Russian. On the bodies of these soldiers, they found what appeared to be a letter in Korean from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and they also noticed that their Russian-issued military IDs were signed in Korean. A Ukrainian special operations soldier named Vlad told us about one case.
Those particular guy, I think his name was Lee, and it said his full real name in Korean. So he basically wrote his name, and Russian didn't realize this.
Also, the Ukrainians say they captured two soldiers alive, and they have shown videos of the POWs speaking in Korean.
What did the Ukrainians tell you about how these soldiers fight on the front line?
Well, Aisha, they were described as fast, agile, and well-trained with artillery, but they appeared not to have much experience with drones. They didn't seem to realize the danger. One Special Forces soldier, Oleksandr, told us about one wounded North Korean soldier found in an intense firefight.
He had lost a lot of blood. He was semi-conscious. Our medic did what he could, and then we had no choice. We had to keep fighting. We hoped he would survive.
That North Korean soldier did not make it, but two others were later captured alive, as I mentioned earlier.
So where do things stand now on the front line?
Well, Russian forces are pushing forward, taking more Ukrainian land in the east, and they have managed to retake part of Kursk. However, a Ukrainian military spokesman says Russia has pulled North Korean troops from parts of the Kursk front line after they suffered these huge losses, at least 1,000 dead. Vlad, the special forces soldier we heard from earlier, expects them to return.
Yeah, we just anticipate where they will appear again to be prepared for the next assault. Usually Russians are not very successful. Only things that help them at the moment is basically North Koreans.
So Vlad told me that they are preparing to face the North Korean soldiers again, and they are even learning a few short Korean phrases so they can address them directly.
That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis. Thank you, Joanna.
You're welcome, Aisha.
When wildfires struck Los Angeles, people had to leave their homes so quickly that many of them left behind medical necessities that are hard to replace. NPR's Alejandra Barunda has the story.
Dora Alman had lived in her Altadena home for 53 years before the Eden fire came raging through.
My husband decided at 9:30 that it was time to go, and so I had 5 minutes to get everything together.
They took almost nothing.
The things that we were wearing, essentially, is all we took.
And the next morning, she realized something.
And I left my glasses, my latest glasses, at the house.
Dora's daughter, Christina, couldn't get her an appointment for new glasses until late February. So when they heard that there'd be a team at this health event that could do eye exams and grind lenses for glasses on demand, they got straight in the car and drove over.
And here they are. Aren't they beautiful? Yes. Doesn't she look great?
It's not just glasses.
We understand that a lot of patients can't get into their primary care doctor.
That's Carla Rugamas. She's a nurse with the nonprofit Vita Mobile Clinic.
They lost their medication, so this is a place where they can get their refills.
And it's not just medications. They pulled together a clothes donation and veterinary care to help animals who had evacuated. Like Mitzi, the 14-year-old Yorkie, and Leia, the heavy-breathing French bulldog.
Thank you.
There were also mental health professionals at the event. They just wanted people to know that they're available to help in English, Spanish, and other languages. Kennedy Kasky works for the healthcare support organization AmeriCares. It supported the event. Kasky deploys all over the country after natural disasters, which she knows are getting more intense because of climate change. Scientists determined the LA fires were more likely and more intense because of it.
So this past year, I mean, I've only had a 6-week break or 8-week break since Helene.
But it only takes one disaster to upend people's lives, like for Dora.
According to my husband, it's time to downsize and nature took care of that.
But at least now she has glasses to help her see where she's going next. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Canada and Mexico say they'll impose tariffs on U.S. products after President Trump announced duties of 25% on most of their goods. He said he'll impose a 10% tariff on Chinese imports. China says it will take countermeasures, including filing a complaint with the World Trade Organization. Russia and Ukraine are blaming each other for a deadly attack in Russia's Kursk region last night, an area under Ukrainian control since August. A bomb struck a boarding school, killing 4 people. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Panama today, his first stop on his first foreign trip in office. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. When he came before the Senate committee considering his nomination to head the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt was asked this by Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington State.
Will you, if confirmed as director, faithfully follow the law, the Empowerment Control Act, yes or no?
Senator, we will faithfully uphold the law. The president ran on the notion that the Empowerment Control Act is unconstitutional. I agree with that.
Turns out the Empowerment Control Act was at the heart of the confusion surrounding the Trump administration's attempt to freeze federal grants and loans last week. And yeah, you're forgiven if you're kind of scratching your head over what that means. We have Stephen Vladeck with us again. He's a Georgetown law professor and author of a newsletter about the Supreme Court called One First. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Aisha. Great to be with you.
So what is the Empowerment Control Act, and why does it matter that President Trump and his OMB director nominee think that it's unconstitutional?
Sure. So I think it might help to take a half step back and talk about what impoundment is first. So impoundment is a sort of fancy term that we've come up with to describe when Congress appropriates money. Congress says, hey, federal government, we want you to go spend this money. And the president says no. And so it's basically a power that a handful of presidents had claimed every couple of years throughout American history on a very small scale, but that had never been endorsed by the Supreme Court, by Congress, by anybody, until Richard Nixon came along. And then Nixon, in the early 1970s, used it so much that Congress finally was impelled to pass a statute, the Empowerment Control Act, to explain when impoundment can happen, and most importantly, when it cannot. And so it's the product, right? It's an effort by Congress to create clarity, where before 1974, we had, you know, a consensus that a president could not impound by himself, but we didn't have resolution.
Okay, and so the Empowerment Control Act says that a president can't just not spend money appropriated by Congress?
It says, in general, presidents can't impound, but then it creates some circumstances where it says maybe you can. So for funds that are not what we call mandatory appropriations, for funds where the executive branch has any discretion about whether to spend the money or how much to spend the money, the Empowerment Control Act authorizes the president to go back to Congress and say, hey, Congress, here's a pool of money I don't want to spend. And the statute, Aisha, creates this procedure for Congress to resolve expeditiously whether it's going to let the president impound those funds or not. The critical point here is, one, that's only, you know, some of the money Congress appropriates. A lot of it can't be impounded at all. And two, there's no argument that that statute is what President Trump's Office of Management and Budget was following last week when it had this crazy, massive federal spending freeze.
Trump and his OMB director nominee, Russell Vogt, they are saying that this law is unconstitutional. Is there a good faith legal argument to be made that favors President Trump's view of impoundment?
No. And, you know, this is not one of those cases where there's like some good arguments on one side and some good arguments on the other. What the president is claiming is what we should call a unilateral power to impound, even when Congress has said, no, you can't. And the executive branch has historically, except, you know, really during like the Nixon administration, taken the position that this power doesn't exist. So in 1985, there was a junior lawyer in the White House counsel's office named John Roberts. We know him better today as the Chief Justice of the United States, who wrote a whole memo on how the president could not impound without help from Congress. The Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, which is, you know, usually pretty pro-executive power, wrote in a 1988 memo that there's just no historical support for a unilateral impoundment power. These examples, you know, they're not like conclusive proof I issue, but they really do testify to just how deeply understood it was that the impoundment power is not something the president's allowed to exercise by himself, because the power of the purse, Congress's control of the appropriations process, is really just about the most important thing Congress does. And if the president could just decline to spend any money Congress appropriates just because he doesn't want to, then that effectively defeats Congress's single most important power, and it really renders Congress much more subservient to the president.
So then how much is this a stress test of the separation of powers?
Oh, I think it's an enormous stress test. I mean, if the president were able to win this fight, if we came out of this, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now with a Supreme Court decision saying actually there are some circumstances in which the president has a unilateral impoundment power, that would be a pretty stunning reallocation of power from Congress to the president. You know, I think this is a stress test for the separation of powers. I think it's a stress test for, you know, the extent to which this administration is going to dig its heels in when it loses in court versus actually sort of stepping back. And frankly, I think we've already seen at least a little bit of backtracking by the Office of Management and Budget rescinding that memo on Wednesday. You know, I don't think we're done with this conversation, of course, but I think that's a sign that they understand they're not on the firmest footing legally.
So where do you see the legal fight over this headed next?
So, you know, we already have two federal courts, one in Washington, D.C., one in Rhode Island, that have blocked any freezes relating to OMB's Monday order. Even though OMB purported to rescind that order on Wednesday, the Rhode Island judge, for example, said, I don't believe you, because the press secretary went out and said, no, we're still freezing funds. Those cases might go forward, Aisha. I think this is not the fight. I think there's going to be a second fight, a second generation effort, where the administration tries in a more nuanced way, perhaps in an area where they have a stronger claim to some overlapping executive power like foreign affairs. I think that's probably the fight the administration is going to try to pick versus trying to get the courts to endorse a unilateral impoundment power in the context of basically cutting off a huge chunk of the entire federal budget.
That's Stephen Vladeck, Georgetown law professor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Aisha.
The 67th Grammy Awards take place tonight in Los Angeles. The award show is a huge celebration of talent in the music industry. And this year, we're likely going to see a generational shift happening in pop music. There's a new wave of talent that rose to stardom this past year, and those artists will be assembled for the first time tonight on the Grammy stage, both to perform and to possibly take home a golden gramophone. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento joins us to talk about that. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
So who are some of the artists in this new wave of pop stars?
So the thing that's really cool about this year is that it's not just one or two new names. There's a lot of new artists who've just totally claimed their star power in a matter of 12 months. It's Doechii, it's Chappell Roan, it's pop underdogs like Charlie XCX and Sabrina Carpenter, who've been around for a while but achieved a new level of success this year. If you told me at the same time last year that all of these people would be some of the biggest names in pop music and on the Grammy stage tonight, I wouldn't have believed you.
Wow.
Wow. But as you said, it seems like some of them have been working at this for a while, like Charlie XCX. She was all over that Icona pop hit, I Love It.
I love that song. That's right, that was from 2012. Charlie's been making music for over a decade, and she's done really well for herself in that time, but for the most part, her career has existed in a more alternative, kind of hyper-pop lane. So it wasn't until she released her album Brat last summer that she really kind of took over the pop world. That's her song 360, and this year's Grammys marked the first time Charlie is nominated as a solo artist. She's up for 7 awards, and her performance at tonight's show will likely cement her new status as one of pop's it girls. We were all talking about Brat Summer when the album came out, but whether or not she wins a Grammy, Charlie taking the stage could mean Brat Summer and her more maximalist, party-fueled pop sound is here to stay.
Oh yeah, we heard so much about that Brat Summer. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Sabrina Carpenter. She's another one of those artists who's been putting out albums for a while, right? But she really hit it in 2024.
Totally. So she was actually a Disney kid, and she's already several albums into her career. But 2024, like you said, Aisha, was the year she finally cracked the code and really found her sound. Her album, Short and Sweet, came out in August, and she had 3 singles at the top of Billboard's Hot 100 chart for months, including Espresso, which is up for Record of the Year. So it's interesting because in the past, there's been a lot of controversy around a former Disney star like Miley Cyrus embracing her sexuality, but Sabrina has totally catapulted into stardom with this really cheeky and seductive image. And you know, being a pop star, a pop diva, it's about more than just having hits. It's about putting on a show. So her performance tonight is a chance to prove that she didn't just climb the ranks of pop, she could be one of its new rulers.
And then there are also 2 true newcomers who will be performing tonight, Chapel Roan and Dochi. Tell us about them.
So Chapel Roan put out her debut album, The Rise and Fall of a Midwest Princess, in 2023. She's up for Album of the Year, Song of the Year, Record of the Year, and Best New Artist. And she makes really synth-heavy, kind of like 80s queer pop anthems. She's completely taken off as well. She played to huge crowds at Coachella and Lollapalooza last year. This is her song, Pink Pony Club. It's where I belong down at the Pink Pony Club. I'm gonna keep on dancing at the Pink Pony Club. I'm gonna keep on dancing down in West Hollywood. I hope she plays Hot to Go. My kids love that song. Yeah, that is definitely one of the big favorites. And there's also Dochi, who is such a breath of fresh air. She's up for Best New Artist, Best Rap Album, and Best Rap Performance. And Dochi, like, she's a really dynamic rapper. She's got the storytelling chops. She's got the look. She's got the choreo. She is the full package. This is Nissan Altima from her mixtape Alligator Bites Never Heal. I'm the new hip by Madonna. I'm the trap Grace Jones. I don't know what type of
crap they own. I'm like Carrie Bradshaw with a back brace on. I've been carrying you now for way too long. Okay, so we can expect to see a little bit of everything tonight. But how do you think this new generation of singers will do when it comes to winning awards?
So in the major categories, we have a ton of huge names nominated alongside those newcomers. Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, Kendrick Lamar, even the Beatles. But winning in the big categories is not necessarily the thing that makes you a star. It's performances at the Grammys that can really make careers. So when it comes to Sabrina, Chapel, Charlie, and Dochi, they're all really magnetic, captivating performers. And tonight they'll have a chance to shine on a bigger stage than ever before.
Now, the Recording Academy decided to go ahead with the Grammys, even though Los Angeles has been just devastated by wildfires. How's that going to affect the tone of the ceremony this year?
Yeah, that's right. So the Grammys have a huge impact on the local economy. So even though a lot of the parties and events leading up to tonight were canceled, they've said not going forward with the show would have been an even bigger blow to the city of Los Angeles. That being said, the tone of the Grammys this year will be a lot more serious and somber, and the show will be largely focused on fundraising efforts for those impacted by the wildfires.
That's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Since January 13th, millions of pilgrims have gathered at a Hindu festival called Kumbh Mela. The event runs for 6 weeks and nearly half a billion people are expected this year. But last week, at least 30 people died in a tragic stampede. Davina Gupta sends us this report from Delhi.
The Hindu religious festival Kumbh Mela takes place every 12 years when Jupiter aligns with the sun and the moon. And people here believe that during this period, taking a dip in the spot where three sacred rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna, and the mythical Saraswati meet, washes away their sins. But as millions of pilgrims make their way to the host city Prayagraj in northern India, managing this massive crowd has been a challenge. For this year, the local government deployed 50,000 security officers. They even used drones to patrol the area. But still, a deadly stampede last week took at least 30 lives and injured 60 others. Puneet Sikka is a documentary filmmaker. She was at the location moments before it all happened. She describes to NPR what she saw.
People were also not complying. Even when the barricades were put, the crowd was constantly pushing.
The local government is now investigating the tragedy, and many pilgrims are blaming a protocol that prioritizes privileged guests. Premanand Puri is a religious leader who is a regular participant at Kumbh Mela.
The government has failed here. When they knew that nearly 500 million people were going to be here, why didn't they let the army manage this event? They only wanted to cater to the VIPs.
He's referring to the practice where authorities block key routes for the cars of politicians and businessmen, making it harder for footbound pilgrims to move freely. Vishal Tiwari is a lawyer who, after the stampede, filed a petition in India's top court to abandon such VIP protocols at Kumbh Mela.
Due to the VIP movements, that crowd was squeezed to a very narrow area. So VIP movement, they shall not be permitted, and maximum space shall be given to the entire devotees who are coming there.
Under pressure, the local government has for now revoked these special perks, like allowing VIP cars in the festival area. But this alone is not enough, says Vikram Singh, a retired police officer who's organized such events in the past. He says security officers need to ensure the crowd keeps moving.
Multiple pilgrims were reported to take multiple dips at the cost of management and at the cost of other pilgrims. I think there should be an element of firmness to move the pilgrims to take a bath and move away.
In addition to this, lawyer Tiwari says that the security instructions need to be multilingual for people coming from different parts of the country.
The announcements, display boards, they are mostly done in Hindi. So, for example, if some any important announcement is there, then person from South India may not understand it.
For now, things have calmed down at the Kumbh Mela. The authorities are more vigilant, says the documentary filmmaker Sikka, who's still there. She hopes things will remain this way until later in February, when the festival finally ends. For NPR News, I'm Davina Gupta in Delhi.
This is NPR News.
The number of Americans who say they use marijuana has more than doubled over the last decade. In many places, it's legal. But finding cannabis products that are safely sourced and properly regulated, well, that can be tricky.
We're talking about a market that lacks transparency and accountability.
So how can consumers figure out how to navigate the marketplace? We'll talk about it on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The U.S. Chamber of Congress says President Trump's plan to impose new tariffs on imports from Mexico, Canada, and China will raise prices for American families and disrupt supply chains. The tariffs are to take effect Tuesday. The interim president of Syria is in Saudi Arabia. Ahmed al-Sharaa is seeking financial assistance in rebuilding his country after more than a decade of war. His rebel group had toppled the longtime leader Bashar al-Assad in December. And the Grammys will be awarded tonight in Los Angeles. Beyoncé has 11 nominations for her latest album, Cowboy Carter. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Being a governess during the Victorian age could be a real drag. There's abuse from spoiled children and their egomaniac rich parents, plus all the misogyny and dehumanizing classism. So what happens when a put-upon governess with a touch of psychopathy, bites back, often literally?
I re-enter the house through the kitchen, where the cook confronts me with a dramatically bloodied nightdress she has found stuffed behind the boiler door. Mrs. Abel says that didn't give us a nightdress to wash this week, she says, so this one must be thine. Yes, I say, taking the nightdress, heavy and crusted, in my hands. Thank you. The cook looks at me, surprised at my accepting the soiled item so readily. But the blood? Natural occurrence, you know, a woman's ailment. But it is all over the neckline. Yes, I say brightly, as if that settles it. Miss Naughty, the cook begins, her face setting into alarm. I feign a fainting spell. I find fainting spells the most rewarding of performances.
That's from the new novel, Victorian Psycho. It's a darkly funny, ultra-violent, gothic tale about a woman who's just not bound by little things like empathy, sympathy, the milk of human kindness. Author Virginia Feito joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Were you reading Jane Eyre and watching American Psycho at the same time and just...
Mixing medications, no, I'm kidding. Actually, the first thing that came to me was one of the lines that's still in the novel at the very beginning. It says something about how her breasts are jiggling in her corset. And that voice, I just couldn't get sort of rid of it. I understood immediately who this character was, and I understood that it was a time period thing, but it was also anachronistic, and it was irreverent, and it was sarcastic, and there was a lot of anger in that voice, and I just gave her a job as a governess, and then I gave her a condition as a psychopath.
Yes. Ms. Naughty, or Winifred Naughty, she's not hiding anything from the reader.
Right.
At the beginning, she lays it all out, saying, it is early fall, the cold is beginning to descend, and in 3 months, everyone in this house will be dead.
Yeah, Winifred is very self-aware, although she's also being very playful. I think she's using this humor to sort of manipulate us into justifying maybe her actions or empathizing with her. But so Winifred Naughty comes to this house, this big, noble sort of English country house, Enser House, named after James Enser, by the way, just because his paintings are totally grotesque and weird. And when I was investigating the Victorian era, I kept coming across these insane sort of stories of abuse and misogyny and cruelty, and evidently servants were not in a great position to fend for themselves, and they were essentially possessions, basically. The children weren't doing great either, working really long hours at the factories. There were like infanticide epidemics. When I was doing the reading and the research, I just kept getting increasingly angry. It was so much that it was kind of funny in a weird way. So that's kind of the voice that is in the pages of this novel.
Can you read one other passage? This is the one where Winifred is in the stables.
Yeah. On the floor next to me lies scattered a pair of wrought iron sugar nips, engraved with a Pound's family crest. There's something sweet lodged between my teeth at the back of my mouth. I presume it is a sugar lump at first, but when I pluck it out, it turns out to be a loose carious molar, mine or somebody else's. It is sticky. Did I extract a tooth with the sugar nips? I really shouldn't drink port after dinner. This is just Winifred doing stand-up comedy, essentially. The whole novel is just like, welcome to my show. I'll be here till Monday.
One of the many strange things about Winifred is that she does seem to have some sort of like oral fixation. She's always putting things in her mouth, like biting
Absolutely.
Things, people, horses. What is that about? Babies often have an oral fixation, right?
Well, that's interesting. I was thinking more of like animals, I think. I remember a note from my editor on one of the early manuscripts. She was like, my girl is always sniffing. She's always sniffing everything, licking everything, sort of touching everything, you know. And especially, I think she's very much drawn to things that we would ordinarily find kind of gross, you know, like somebody's, I don't know, gross like mole with like hair sticking out of it. And I think she's kind of like visceral and animalistic.
Winifred does find like a kindred spirit in one of her charges, teenage Drusilla Pounds. What do you think that Winifred and Drusilla see in each other?
Winifred, I think, dismisses Drusilla at first immediately. And I think many readers will, because honestly, as a writer, I did too. Like, oh, just another like rich teenage girl, whatever. And then suddenly I was like, wait, there's something to tap here. Like, she probably has an incredibly insane like inner life, this girl. She's living in these walls. Her brother is the heir. Her parents don't care about her education because why bother? You know, she just has to like marry off eventually. Obviously, nobody cares about her personality or her hobbies. What hobbies? Servants obviously had awful lives, but like, I'm not sure that rich people were any better off, especially women. They couldn't exercise because they thought, you know, their wombs would drop out or whatever. Creative things were frowned upon for them. You know, they just had to like sit down and be obedient. So I think Drusilla and Winifred have something in common. There's a certain darkness growing inside of them. It's different in each of them, right? Because they come from different backgrounds. And I think we all do carry a darkness inside of us, whatever that may look like. You know, it could be something that we're trying to control, something that we don't like, something like greed or envy or...
Or anger, rage. Speaking personally.
Let's talk more about that. But yeah, they're kindred spirits in a surprising way, I think, eventually in the end, as I guess maybe we all are.
Thinking about this story, there really is no redemption. There's no one, as we have said, to really root for. Is there a larger meaning to this story, or is it just kind of a bloody romp for people like me who love this sort of thing?
I mean, that's a great reading as well, but I did layer it a lot with a lot of like abstract big concepts like evil, for example, and the nature of it, where it comes from, you know, the motivations of different people for committing different evil acts. And there's also a bit of like questioning on how we're doing the feminist take that is sort of in fashion, but then I wonder sometimes whether we're making women just cool all the time without wondering if maybe they're just evil or they're like not worthless justifying their actions, or if they are killers. In a lot of like popular culture, they're usually portrayed as very sexy, talented killers instead of just like brutes, basically. And I wanted to touch on the way that women don't often kill the same way men do, you know, and explore that. What would happen if a woman essentially started murdering in a way that is very bloody? Like, usually women throughout history have murdered with poison. It's different. It's more intimate. It's more psychological. So I think I wanted to see a woman just murder for no reason, just other than pleasure. So either or, it's all good. And each reader can decide out how seriously they take it. But I did want to layer it in with some kind of complex questions as well.
That's Virginia Fato. Her new book is Victorian Psycho. Thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much. It's been such a joy.
Our crew in the NPR newsroom learned last week that the phrase winter blues hit a five-year high on Google search. Seems way more people are searching for a tropical beach vacation than a ski trip, and I know the feeling. If you need a cure for the winter blahs, we have some. NPR's Barry Hardiman, avid reader and watcher of things, is here. Hi, Barry.
Hi there.
And also Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, also an avid reader and watcher of things. Hi, Linda.
Hello, hello.
Let's just set the scene here. You're curling up for a cozy Sunday. What's good to have on hand if you're trying to do a little self-care, just trying to take care of yourself?
Could it be a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday?
Any day these days.
I think on a cozy any day, Barry and I, while we were talking about this, agreed that you got to have a couple different things. We like the self-heating mug.
You don't want to have to get up.
No. Keeps your drink warm. And we're electric blanket people, right, Barry?
Hugely. Lately, I have really been sort of reduced to opening up my phone and looking at puppy videos. And what I realized actually over the last 70 weeks of January is that you can search for particular kinds of things. And what my favorite thing is, and I cannot recommend this highly enough, is a medium-aged dog getting a puppy or a kitten of its own.
It's for you. We got a present.
The first couple of days, he was kind of scared of her. She was so tiny.
I felt my heart rate slow.
Mine is less cuddly, but in my opinion, equally relaxing. I play simulator games, usually either on like a PS5 or a lot of them I play on PC. I build a city, and then you got to set up all the city services and figure out like where's the school going to go and all that stuff. Love those. Love to make the electricity work with a wind farm instead of a coal plant, you know, just it feels like a little win. You can also do like a fast food restaurant simulator. There's a great one that I love where you build your own zoo.
I love a salon.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you simulator. Can do, yes. I also love a salon, but yes.
You can do salon ones. Mm-hmm. So I like to literally construct my own world. And even if sometimes there's a little too much traffic and I have to rebuild all the roads.
Oh, no.
I know that I can make things right within my city.
I like these. I like what y'all, but I understand y'all also here to give us some recommendations. So let's start with what to watch when you're trying to chase those winter blues away. Linda, what do you suggest?
So I have two basic suggestions. One is what I would call gentle TV. And there's a whole world of kind of shows that are, they're still funny, they're still fun, but they're a little bit more kind of humane and kind-hearted than a lot of television. One is A Man on the Inside, which is on Netflix, which stars Ted Danson as a guy who goes undercover as a resident in a senior living facility.
Julie, it is 7:05 a.m. To recap our suspect list, 15 staff members have been ruled out. 4 were on duty during both crimes. First is Penny, the med tech. She seems pleasant and hardworking.
Alice, time to walk.
But this job may be getting to her.
No! Alice, Jerry, you gotta lock the door. I put a sock on the knob, something.
Sorry.
Dennis the chef was working both nights.
It is one of the few shows I know that gives kind of full shape and breadth and humanity to the older people who live there. And my other one is satisfying tasks on YouTube. So there are a couple of people who go out and clear drains during rainstorms. There's one of these videos that has 30 million views. The guy goes out and takes a rake and clears out all the drains, and eventually all the rainwater that's flooding the streets kind of just sucks down into the drains.
That whirlpool is awesome. Oh, it's almost gone. You can see the center divide now. We're making a ton of progress. I'm gonna go across the street now.
Amazing, so satisfying. Also, rug cleaning. There's a video that's like 6 hours of rug cleaning to help you fall asleep because they clear off these rugs and they get all the dirt off and the pattern emerges.
I will also note, just to combine those things, Linda, for you, if you don't know about it, there's a game on the PS5, which is just power washing. Like, you power wash things.
I play it. It's called Power Wash Simulator.
It's good. I mean, it really helped our household until we fought over it.
I love Power Wash Simulator.
Barry, what about things to read?
Well, a couple things. Everybody's going to feel differently about this, but I am an avid sci-fi fantasy person, which already you're in a different world. So let's start with my favorite of all time, which is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is a marvelous, marvelous series by Douglas Adams. It's decades old, but it's really hilarious. You only spend a little bit of time on Earth because Earth is destroyed very early on. I just want to warn you about that. But you're kind of like, okay, anyway, Earth. And you move on, and it is truly a series of characters and ridiculous things that are exactly that sort of blend of genuine comedy and sweetness and real philosophy. Now, you can consume the books. I recommend them. You can also consume the BBC radio plays, which are incredible.
To tell the story of the book, it's best to tell the story of some of the minds behind it. A human from the planet Earth was one of them. His name is Arthur Dent. He is a 6-foot-tall ape descendant, and someone is trying to drive a bypass through his home.
Come off it, Mr. Dent. You can't win, you know. Look, there's no point in lying down in the path of progress.
I've gone off the idea of progress. It's overrated. But you
must. Another thing I actually really like to do is go down to real dystopia. With this, I'm talking like Silo, which is also a great TV series about a post-apocalyptic world where humans are living underground in silos. The television series is also great, and it's different, and it's kind of nice to be able to compare how they're different. I like them both equally. They have different things to say about being underground in a post-apocalypse situation, but it's great. You have so much to consume, and I find myself, you know, like, I don't want half the baked potato at this time of year. I want the whole thing, and I want it with both butter and olive oil, which is actually my last tip.
That's Barry Hardiman and Linda Holmes working the cozy beat for NPR. We appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
Guyana, King of Bernada. If you got a good bull, Guyana, feed your bull good at all. Boy, feed him good at home. It may come along a young heifer and just tore your bull from home. Oh, my bull's in a pasture, babe. Lord, why there's no